Previously on The Accidental Terrorist.
The year is 1987, the time late February. Our hero, Elder Bill Shun, an outwardly devout 19-year-old from Utah, has been called to serve 2 years as a missionary in the wild and foreign land of Alberta, Canada. Severely homesick, he has already attempted to flee his mission, only to be turned back and convinced to give it another go. But then, faced with another missionary, Elder Finn, trying to run away, Elder Shun does the unthinkable. Phones in a bomb threat in a last-ditch effort to keep Finn from leaving. Through a series of ghastly missteps, Elder Shun finds himself in the custody now of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police and under arrest. The Accidental Terrorist, a memoir by William Shun. Chapter 29. Cellmates. The slamming of the cell door reverberated into silence like the echoing of a gong. I could not move a muscle. The cell was a cave, a filthy white grotto in the bowels of the earth. Walls so bright with artificial light that not even closed eyelids could shut out the harsh incandescence. 3 walls of thickly coated concrete, each with a bench bolted to it. 1 wall of bars. In one corner, a metal partition screened a stainless steel toilet. Patches of mildew and rust merged at the corners of the ceiling, and 2 oversized light bulbs in mesh cages blazed overhead. The men slouched on the benches regarded me with the frank inscrutability of zoo animals. Threadbare clothing, dirty faces, greasy hair, unshaven cheeks. They ranged in apparent age from 16 to 40. Smoke from their half-dozen cigarettes hung in the air, overlaying the miasma of years of spent butts. My clothes were rumpled but free of stain, my cheeks sandpapery but recently shaven, my hair tousled but freshly cut. I was less a person than a series of violations of the local standards of hygiene. The pads of my fingers were stained black from fingerprinting, but my nails were neat and clean. Soapy water dripped from my hands. I wiped them on the back of my jeans and took a seat on the bench against the rear wall. It didn't take long for the wolves to come nosing around. "Got any smokes?" asked the guy nearest me, some loser in a worn leather jacket with a nearly spent butt between his fingers. All eyes were still on me. It was cold in the cell, cold and dank, and I shivered despite my sweater. "No, sorry," I said, and sorry I was.
"Matches?"
I cleared my throat. "No." The guy nodded and went back to his butt, dragging down to the filter. The force of attention in the cell relaxed. "No meat here," the detainees seemed to tell one another. I had nothing that interested these men, and so I became invisible. There was no clock and no window. Time seemed to skitter and stop. On June 24th, 1844, Joseph Smith set out on horseback from Nauvoo, Illinois, in the company of his brother Hiram and several other men. They were bound for the nearby city of Carthage, there to stand trial on charges of riot for the destruction of the Nauvoo Expositor 2.5 weeks earlier. Turning himself in was not Joseph's preferred legal strategy. Anti-Mormon sentiment in Illinois had never been more virulent. The rest of the state feared the prophet and the political and military power of the theocracy he had established at Nauvoo, and Joseph had every reason to fear mob violence if he ended up incarcerated on unfriendly soil. Earlier, when Governor Thomas Ford had asked him to submit to the law in Carthage, Joseph had agreed only on the condition that his city's militia be allowed to escort him there. Ford, foreseeing civil war should the Nauvoo Legion march upon Carthage, forbade this, and Joseph fled to Iowa rather than face arrest. Joseph's hope was to spare his own life and to spare his people armed conflict. But after a posse searched Nauvoo vainly for the prophet, the leaderless city fell into a panic. Would an army show up next, seeking its own disproportionate brand of justice? Governor Ford was guaranteeing the prophet safe passage to Carthage and a fair trial once there. And at the urging of several intimates, including his brother and his wife, Joseph reluctantly agreed to deliver himself into custody to forestall any hostilities, reportedly saying, "If my life is of no value to my friends, it is of none to myself." When Joseph and the rest arrived in Carthage, having walked a gauntlet of wicked taunts from rival militiamen, the cases against most of them were deferred and the men went free on bail. Joseph and Hiram, however, were both bound over on charges of treason, stemming from Joseph's alleged declaration of martial law at Nauvoo when the posse arrived to arrest him. A flimsy charge, but good enough for his enemies at Carthage. Joseph entered the Carthage jail with the dread certainty that he would never see the outside of it again. My own arrest had not been nearly so dramatic. I sat across from Constable Remington in numb silence as he informed me, under Section 10 of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, of my right to know the reasons for my arrest, to retain counsel without delay, and to have the validity of my detention determined by way of habeas corpus. The cadence of the words was very similar to that of the familiar Miranda warning read to detainees in the United States, but the content was different enough that I felt a strange sense of dislocation, as if Rod Serling had smugly delivered me into some parallel universe where none of the rules I had learned from television applied. The charge was public mischief. Willful interference with the lawful use and enjoyment of public or private property valued in excess of $1,000. When I asked the constable what kind of sentence that carried, he said he honestly didn't know. "Couldn't be too bad, though," he said. I got the idea the innocuous charge was his favor to me. Wanting to cooperate the best I could, I forewent the right to immediate counsel and wrote a confession. I labored over the report of my motives, in the end opting to ascribe my crime to a more noble concern for my compatriot's soul over my actual base desire to keep my own ass off Prez's hot seat. When I had signed the confession and tried, without success, to call President Tuttle or Elder Snow, I sat in the stark, tiny airport jail for nearly an hour until two city detectives arrived to take me downtown. We stopped over at a suburban police precinct that seemed to have been fathered by the same architect who designed the most recent generation of Mormon churches, low, rambling, and Warren-like, with flat tan carpeting on the walls as well as the floors. Here, in a cell more like a closet-sized conference room, I gave the lady detective an oral confession, and she in turn gave me my new label, terrorist. After another long wait, during which I finally reached President Tuttle by phone and learned that half the missionaries in Calgary were out searching for me, the detectives transferred me to the Remand Center downtown. This was a 5-story concrete monolith in the heart of the city, housing both courts and jails. There, I was photographed and fingerprinted and thrown into that barren holding cell. The number of detainees in the cell was in continuous flux, as guys present got hauled off to bail hearings or more permanent quarters, and replacements got dragged in fresh from the street. A lot of men rotate through the holding cell. Aging biker types in leather, swaggering punks, surly teenagers, some Southeast Asian hoods, a wino or two. But not one of them struck me as someone I wanted to know. There was no love in me that night, only fear and loathing. That's the other thing. Not one of my transient cellmates failed to frighten me. My rule was to keep my head down and not make eye contact. That way, I might render myself invisible. Even when the cops dumped a middle-aged businessman in with us, a potential ally, I didn't break my silence, and he was so sunk in his own misery that I knew he would never say a word to me. In fact, I might have scared him just as much as everyone else scared me. Who could say? I waited patiently for my turn, for my name to be called, for the cops to unlock the door and drag me off to my date with freedom, but it kept not happening. It happened to everyone else around me, even Mr. Capitalist in his Brooks Brothers suit, but the living world, it seemed, had forgotten me. After what could have been a couple of hours or a couple of days, I looked around. In wonderment, like waking from a dream, I realized I had the cell to myself. I was alone. I took advantage of the temporary lull to visit the toilet behind its ineffectual screen. I paced. I talked to myself. I wondered aloud if the Blanchards now hated me for missing our dinner appointment, if the news of my arrest would destroy any chance the Buckinghams had of joining the church. And what about my parents? What would my father say when he heard about this? What was he going to think of me? How on earth could I ever have been so flippin' stupid? From somewhere inside bubbled up a fragment of an old Disney tune, corrupted by some subconscious hack. The second cell to the right smells like recycled beer. I giggled, picturing Tinkerbell hustling in the big city. All it takes is faith and trust, I said aloud, and a little bit of angel dust. As if my voice had summoned it, there came such a commotion from down the hall that my blood froze. I hurried to the front of the cell. Through the bars, straining my eyes to the left, I could see four Calgary police officers wrestling a new prisoner into the cell block, and he was kicking like a bronco fresh from the chute. His hands were cuffed behind his back, but that hadn't taken the fight out of him. "Fuck 'em pigs!" he screamed. "The fuck is this? These fuckers jumped me, you shit for brains!" The cops slammed their prisoner up against the bars of my cell, face first. The man's eyes were wide and wild. I scrambled back to the far bench, heart pounding. The man's eyes looked into mine. With a sudden gasp, he sucked in a lungful of air, and his eyes got even bigger. The cops were twisting his arms up behind his back. Teeth bared, eyes squeezed shut, he started kicking. A tall, red-faced corrections officer was fumbling a key in the lock. "Shit, watch his legs!" one of the cops yelled. "Hurry it up, Chuck, come on!" The look clicked over. I'm sorry, the lock clicked over, and the realization hit me like a silent freight train. They were putting him in with me. "No," I told myself, shaking my head. "No way, no, no." But my disbelief couldn't bar the door. The cops shoved the new guy through and down to the floor, one of them keeping a foot jammed in the small of his back while another unlocked his cuffs. The one with the foot gave the guy an almost playful kick in the ass on the way out. The corrections officer slammed the door shut. "Fuckers," said the prisoner weakly, pushing himself up from the floor. He launched himself against the door, rattling it like a box of bones. "Motherfuckers! This is harassment! I'll sue your shitty asses!" The only response was the closing of a door somewhere farther down the hall. My new cellmate turned away from the bars. "Fucking pigs think they're God or something," he said to me, eyes agleam with righteous indignation. He started to pace. I shrugged, my pulse beating fast in my ears. I didn't want to agree with him, but I didn't want to disagree either. The guy continued to pace. I swung my feet up onto the bench and sat watching him with my arms wrapped around my knees. I would have preferred to ignore him and go back to being invisible, but that was no longer an option. Like a fox cornered by a hunting dog, I was afraid to take my eyes off him. He wore cowboy boots and a faded Jack Daniels t-shirt one size too small. His brown corduroys were also too small, and the hole where one of his back pockets was ripped showed bare flesh, no skivvies. He was thin, and his chest was narrow, but what muscles I could see were lean and wiry. Perhaps by a trick of the cell's harsh light, he looked both young and old, with straggling brown hair and a skimpy mustache. Blood had dried on his chin and under his nose, but still trickled from cuts under his eye and high on one arm. He had a bruise on his cheek and a split lower lip, and he limped a little. Though his gait was bow-legged, he didn't walk quite like a cowboy. He reminded me more of a wind-up toy, the spring inside coiled so tightly it would break if not allowed to run down. "Assault and fucking battery," he said with a sneer, fists clenched. His boots clicked on the cold concrete floor. "What a crock of shit. It was 4-on-1, a goddamn free-for-all. Fuckers bust into your mum's house. What are you supposed to do? Invite 'em back for a fucking cocktail? Bastards took her TV. Fuck!" He stopped and shook his hand at me, as if to lament the sorry state of the world. I shrugged again. "Her goddamn Christmas present," he said, smacking his fist into the palm of his hand. As if he'd given himself a jump start, he jerked back into motion. "Her Christmas present, and they fucking boost it. I paid him for it, too, so down I go to Scooters to talk to these fucks, and they're making like they don't remember any payment, asking if I got a goddamn receipt. Called themselves the Repo Squad, and fucking laughed in my face. Can you believe this? So I call them the Shit-Faced Fucking Liars Squad, and I paid them, and I want my damn TV, and then I don't know. They're all up in my face, and then there's fists, and there's elbows, and there's bottles and blood, and I'm down on the ground, and the fucking cops are there, and they grab me. Assault and fucking battery." He snorted an angry breath and shook his head. "And still they get away with the fucking TV." He threw himself down on the opposite bench and pulled a crumpled pack of Cools out of the front pocket of his corduroys. With a few quick shakes, he had a cigarette stuck in the corner of his mouth, dangling. He squinted into the pack, then turned it upside down and shook it some more. With a disgusted look, he tossed the empty pack into the corner. The torn paper matchbook he pulled out of his pocket next did him no better. "Shit," he said blandly. "You got a light on you, kid?" My eyes snapped back to him. My contact lenses were drying out, and I'd let my gaze drift away as I tried to blink up some tears. No, sorry, I stammered. I looked at my shoe. "I'm not really a smoker." "Huh," he grunted. Shoulders hunched, hands dangling between his knees, he peered at me from hollow sockets. "Then you got nothing else to do in this hole but climb the fucking walls." He stood up and went to the bars. "Hey, Chuckles," he called out. "Yeah, you. How about some matches back here, eh?" To my surprise, a fresh book of matches sailed between the bars, hit my cellmate in the shoulder, and dropped to the floor. "Just keep it down back there," said the voice of the corrections officer. With a grin that showed me stained and crooked teeth, my cellmate picked up the matchbook. His cigarette was still spit-glued to the corner of his mouth. As he sat down again, he struck a match, puffed his cigarette to life, and waved the match flame to a cinder. The smell of fresh tobacco smoke bloomed again in the air. It was the smell of my Uncle Dale's house when I was a kid, and I found it oddly comforting. We sat in silence as my cellmate patiently dragged. "You know," he said a few minutes later, looking around the cell like a potential real estate buyer, "this place really sucks." I must have grinned without realizing it, because his face turned serious and he poked his cigarette in my direction. "You think I'm cracking a joke here? You think I'm running my mouth? No, let me tell you, kid, this place sucks the high hard one. I mean, I'm sure you think it's rough being locked up for the night, but you can't fucking start to appreciate how bad it really is. Not like I can." He took a deep drag and blew the smoke out in a thin, angry stream. His voice got low and growly. "I wouldn't wish this place on my worst enemy." My cellmate absently stubbed out his cigarette on the bench beside him, half-smoked. He looked down and seemed surprised at what he'd done. He straightened out what was left. Bits of tobacco sprinkled his knees. "I'm 29 years old, and I've been in 10 years already," he said as he relit the cigarette. "I got this little girl I don't even hardly know. Those guys that jumped me? When I'm out of here, I'm going to find them and kick the living shit out of them. I could put a man in the hospital, but I won't ever put him in jail. No way. I won't do that to anyone." He sat down, his posture drained of its previous electricity. He leaned forward and rubbed the back of his neck. 70 fucking days, he said. "That's all I've been out this time, man. Probation's in the shit can now." He looked at me almost angrily, hand still behind his neck. "Why the fuck am I telling you this anyway?" He, grimacing as if in pain, he arched his back. "How old are you, kid?" 19, I said, huddling a little more tightly around my knees. "Been in before? You haven't, have you?" No. Shit. He shook his head and squinted at the lights. "When I was your age, I'd already done a year for armed robbery. Juvie shit before that. What are you in for?" The charge seemed so innocuous beside armed robbery, so inconsequential that I didn't want to answer. But that wouldn't have been respectful. "Public mischief," I said. His lip curled. "The fuck is that? I mean, public mischief? They catch you toilet paper in trees or what?" My face grew hot. "I made a bomb threat, okay? I said there was a bomb on an airplane." "No shit," my cellmate said mildly. "Nope." He looked at me now without so much amusement. In fact, he looked almost impressed. "Why'd you do that?" I looked away, into the unrelenting white of the corridor. I stopped, trying to work the rough edges out of my voice. "It's a long story. You don't want me to get into it." "I got nothing but time, eh? I don't know about you." My face went hard. "Does it matter?" He shrugged, studying his vanishingly short cigarette. "I don't know. Probably not." I stared into the corridor for what seemed like hours. I took a deep breath and let it out slowly. I was afraid that if I said too much, I'd be trapped in that jail forever, like Persephone eating the pomegranate seeds in hell. But I couldn't keep it in. I massaged the bridge of my nose, choosing my words cautiously. "I have this friend," I said. "We work together. Today he tells me he's tired of Calgary and wants to pull out. He's flying home to California. He's got a plane ticket, and his bags are all ready to go. He wants me to take him to the airport." I closed my eyes. "But I tell him he's making a huge mistake. He's just running away from his problems. I try to talk him out of it, but he won't have it. His mind's made up. He's not listening." My cellmate nodded his head soberly. "So you call in a bomb threat to stop his plane?" I felt suddenly transparent. "Something like that, yeah." He rested his arms on his knees, eyebrows knitted. "What I don't get is, how do you know it was a mistake for him to go? I mean, how can you know what's wrong or right for somebody else?" My eyes started to burn. "I just knew it, okay?" "You just knew it." He didn't sound convinced. "Look, I've been where he is. I almost ran away myself at Christmas, but it's not worth it. It's just not." My cellmate took a final drag on his cigarette and stubbed it out. "You know, kid, you probably couldn't have done something dumber if you tried. You're in some deep fucking shit, my friend." I nodded miserably. "But at least your heart was in the right place," he said. The world grew watery as I stared at him in surprise. President Tuttle had said the same thing to me when I talked to him from the suburban precinct, but it didn't wound me the way I was wounded now. "Yeah," I said softly, thinking of Elder Deadman. His heart had been in the right place. Mine hadn't. "I mean, you really fucking stuck your neck out," my cellmate said. "I hope your friend appreciates that." I snorted to myself. Yeah, me too. So did it work? Did he stick around? No clue, I said. I got arrested before I found out. I wouldn't have gone, said my cellmate. No fucking way. Not if someone was willing to go to jail to stop me. He doesn't even know what I did. He knows. His voice was quiet and assured. You stopped his plane, didn't you? I guess. Man, if someone would have called in a bomb threat on me... He shook his head. That kid doesn't know how lucky he is to have a friend like you. A lump rose in my throat. The silence stretched. Several times over the next few minutes, it looked like he was going to say something more, but he didn't actually get it out until the fourth or fifth go. Hey, kid, he said, as if he'd just been struck by an offhand thought. You gonna be in town a while? I don't know. Depends on a lot of things, I guess. Well, you ought to give me a call. We could get together sometime, maybe. Seeing this guy again was suddenly important to me. He had dealt with me respectfully and honestly, and I felt more grown up and worthwhile in his presence than I had in all my time as a missionary. Yeah, okay, I said. Listen, while we're on it, let me ask you something, said my cellmate. If you don't want to answer, that's okay. I'll understand. I'm just kind of curious. No, go ahead. He seemed a little embarrassed. What is it you do for a living? You never said exactly. Embarrassed myself, I stared at my hands. My anonymity, the first I'd had in months, had felt like a shield in jail. I was reluctant to give it up. You probably wouldn't believe me if I told you, I say. No, I'll believe you. Why would you lie? I'm a Mormon missionary. His eyes widened momentarily, but then a mask of sang-froid descended. Hey, that's cool, he said, holding his hands up, palms out. That's okay, I can handle that. You believe in what you're doing, I can respect that. I mean, you know, I think about God sometimes. My arms turned to goosebumps. All my training was in how to turn opportunities just like this one to my advantage. And almost without thought, a perfectly executed relating the gospel to your investigators' lives flowed like honey from my lips. Lots of people believe in a supreme being. We know him as God, just like you do, and we believe... Sudden footsteps and jangling keys interrupted, and the door to our cell ground open. Two corrections officers stood there. Not now, I thought. My bail hearing can't possibly be now. But the officers called out a name that was not mine. So befuddled was I that I didn't catch what it was. Yeah, I'm here, my cellmate said wearily. Where the fuck else would I be? Let's go, said the first officer. Upstairs. My cellmate stood and hitched up his torn corduroy pants. You give me a call, kid. I'll beat this. We'll get together. A pit yawned in my stomach. How do I call you? I said. The second officer snapped a pair of handcuffs on my friend's wrists and shoved him out of the cell. Come on, this ain't no goddamn social club. The cell door slammed shut. My friend was reciting numbers, but the corrections officers were already hustling him away down the corridor. Good luck, kid, he called. See you on the outside. I watched them disappear, feeling more alone than ever. A guard came for me sometime later. Visitors, he said. Let's go. I waded back to awareness, rubbing my eyes. I hadn't been asleep, but I had certainly zoned out there for a while. The guard unlocked the cell. Visitors, come on! At some point, the lights in the cell block had dimmed, simulating night. I blinked, having not quite caught up with reality. What about my bail hearing? I don't think there are any more bail hearings tonight, said the guard. Your lawyers probably know more about that than I do. Come on. My lawyers? I wondered as the guard guided me along a corridor silent save for the hollow tapping of our shoes. We opened a door, and he opened a door and motioned me inside. It was a small, dim interview room with a table and two chairs. President Tuttle stood up as I entered. With him, already standing, was a tall, gray-haired gentleman with rimless square glasses whom I thought I recognized from church meetings around town. Both wore dark suits and ties, and Tuttle's eyes glittered with feverish cheer. "Elder Shun, are you okay?" he asked as he caught me up in one of his squishy, warm hugs. "Yes," I said, muffled against his shoulder, "pretty much." He released me and bade me sit. One of my suits hung over the back of the other chair. The guard was watching us through a slit in the door, only his eyes visible. "I'm sorry Elder Snow couldn't see you," said President. "He's outside in the waiting room with Elder Bruce. They made us wait hours to see you, and then they'd only let two of us in." It was Elder Snow I wanted most to see. "What time is it?" I asked, disappointed. The other man looked at his watch. 12:30, he said, in a rural accent that didn't fit with his fine blue suit. My mind reeled. Only a little more than 2 hours since they'd brought me downtown. With all that had happened in that time, and all that hadn't, it didn't seem possible. "Thanks," I said. "They took my watch, and I've been going crazy without it." "Who did?" asked Tuttle, with fraying concern. "The other prisoners?" "The police." He visibly pulled himself together. "Of course, of course. Well, Elder Shun, you've met President Harvey before, I believe." The tall man shook my hand as I stood. "Fred Harvey," he said. "I've seen you in stake correlation meetings." "Oh, yes," I said. "President Harvey's a counselor to your stake president. He's also an attorney, and he's volunteered his services to help out here." "Thank you very much," I said sincerely. "So you're a criminal attorney?" "Corporate," said Harvey. "But this is a pretty straightforward case. I don't foresee any problems. Go ahead and sit down, Elder. Let me explain the situation here. Your bail hearing will be first thing in the morning. It should have been tonight, but the Crown Prosecutor's Office has gotten hold of this and won't let go. That's the Crown Prosecutor of Alberta, equivalent to a state's attorney general, where you come from." That made me shudder. "He's taken a personal interest in this case," said Harvey, "and has, in fact, let it be understood in the judiciary that you are not under any circumstances to be released on bail tomorrow. With the Olympics coming up next year, he wants to send a clear message to the world that this province is not soft on terrorism." There was that word again. "But I'm not a terrorist," I protested. "We know that," said Harvey, "but the Crown Prosecutor's convinced that you are. Not to worry, though. I think the magistrate can still be convinced to let you go." "And you don't have to worry about the money," said President Tuttle. "The mission has that covered." "You'll be free tomorrow," said Harvey. "But as for tonight, well, I'm afraid you'll have to spend it in the pokey." I had come to this realization, of course, but his words still cranked the local gravity up a few notches. And since I didn't share his optimism about the next day, I sagged even further in my chair. President Harvey asked me a few questions next, mostly to clarify my motives in preparation for the morning's hearing. Then glanced up at the slit in the door. "We won't have much longer here," he said. "We'd better get you changed." Tuttle stood up, lifting the suit from the back of his chair. Until then, it hadn't really hit me what it was for. But, I stammered, filled with dread. "You've got to look respectable for the hearing tomorrow," said Tuttle. "You've got to carry yourself like a representative of the Lord. That's how you're going to get off." He seemed to think I was checking into some hotel for the night. No conceivable sartorial makeover was going to render me respectable in the morning, not after sleeping in my clothes. There were no hangers in the big house, no clothes presses in the cooler. All the suit would accomplish is increase my allure as a target for taunting, violence, and molestation. Had President never been to the movies, for Pete's sake? But this was my mission, President. If I obeyed him, like I'd been trying to do all day, then I'd be protected. Tuttle and Harvey turned their backs as I skinned out of my sweater and jeans and slipped into my brown suit. I traded my sneakers for thick-soled dress shoes and knotted a cheery yellow tie around my neck. Elder Snow, who had assembled my clothes, hadn't forgotten my name tag, and I clipped it to my breast pocket as if bolting my final plate of armor into place. "Oh, when that judge sees you, Elder," declaimed President Tuttle, turning back to face me, "there's no chance he'll keep you locked up. Not beside all these criminals in here." Publicans and sinners, I thought, seeing my corduroy friend in my mind's eye. The guard rapped on the door. 2 minutes, he called out. "We'd better wrap things up," said Harvey. "Just a second," I said. "President, do you think..." Well, I hesitated, embarrassed. "Do you think I could get a blessing? Really quick, even?" Tuttle glanced at Harvey almost as if he were looking for permission. "Certainly, of course," Tuttle said. "Sit down." I took a seat, and the two men laid their hands on my head. President Tuttle pronounced a short but not hasty blessing upon me, promising that the Lord would comfort and protect me throughout the night and see to it that I emerged safely from this period of trial. I felt calmer afterward, a sensation that lasted all of 5 minutes. The guard didn't return me to the holding cell. He escorted me instead to a property window on a higher floor, where another officer looked me over. This one relieved me of my tie, belt, and plastic name tag. A hulking guard beckoned to me from an open doorway nearby. He moved aside to let me precede him into the passage beyond, though he was so tall and fat that I still scraped the door jamb as I squeezed past him. He towered over me in his blue uniform by nearly a foot, and his sparse, boyish mustache and mean little porcine eyes made him look like an overgrown junior high bully. He directed me ahead down the long, narrow passageway, and as he followed, I imagined his bulk compressing the air before him like the head of a piston, bearing me irresistibly forward. We rounded a corner, and the guard grunted me left into a dirty white box of a room, devoid of any feature but a naked light bulb overhead and a drain cover in the center of the floor. The room was so close, I could feel the weight of 1,000 tons of concrete above my head. As I was assessing the room, surely not my night's quarters, I hoped, the guard lumbered up to plug the doorway behind me. "Strip," he said, in a voice like the grinding of boulders. I turned toward him. "Pardon me?" I said, my brain having not yet caught up with my ears. "You heard me," he barked. His voice echoed deafeningly in the little room. "Strip! Now!" Civilization seemed 1,000,000,000 miles away. Apparently my blessing of comfort and protection had worn off somewhere on the way up from the interview room. Reluctantly, I shrugged off my suit jacket and looked for a place to lay it. The guard snatched it from me impatiently. "Come on, everything," he bellowed. "Go, go!" I untied my shoes while he ran his hands over every panel and seam of my jacket. He took the shoes and pounded the heels against the wall as I removed my pants and shirt. I stood there shivering in only my garments, which Gentiles were not supposed to see. The guard's face burned a deep scarlet when he looked up from his inspection. "Am I talking packy, motherfucker? I said everything, now!" Cowering, I slipped out of my garments and handed them over. More distressing than my nakedness was the way the guard profaned every inch of my sacred underclothes with his fat, clumsy mitts. I was afraid all protective capacity would be gone from my garments by the time I put them back on. if that time ever came. When he'd confirmed I was hiding no drugs, knives, or grenade launchers in my skivvies, the guard draped them with the rest of my clothes over the top of the open door. "Now face me and stand up straight," he ordered. The cold of the cement floor streamed in through the soles of my bare feet and set my bones a-thrum. My dick was completely shriveled. Stepping forward, the guard eyed me like a piece of maggoty meat in his lunch pail. "Tilt your head toward me and run your hands through your hair," he said. I followed his instructions. My hands shook so badly I could hardly control them. "Fold down your ears," he said. "Open your mouth. Raise your tongue. Lift up your arms." His eyes slid further down my body as I passed each phase of his inspection. Then he produced a rubber glove from his pocket. "Turn around and bend over," he said, tugging the latex down over his fingers like sausage casings. The eyes in his sweaty face focused on his hand with dim purposefulness. I did as he said, clenching my eyes shut like fists. My heart wandered naked and lost on a frozen Arctic plain. Hands on my knees, I heard the sterile slap of the glove snapping tight against his wrist. "Now spread your cheeks," he said. My entire body tensed. I strained and strained with my glutes, awaiting his tender ministrations. "I said spread your cheeks, you stupid hump!" I opened my eyes, and through my tented legs I could see him crouched upside down, a crazy quarterback waiting for some obscene snap, one tumescent finger poised and quivering. "I'm trying! I'm trying!" I cried in desperation. "Not telepathically, goddammit! Now put your hands on your cheeks and spread 'em!" My hands flew back of their own accord and slapped my ass with a double-barreled report. I yanked my cheeks apart like two halves of a peach and closed my eyes. The world slowed on its axis. "Okay, get dressed," the guard said contemptuously, peeling off the glove. He straightened up and threw my clothing at me, all in a wad. I was tugging my second shoe on when the guard prodded me back into the passageway. Shuffling to keep my foot from popping out of the shoe, I followed him through a labyrinth of concrete and darkness. We stopped in an area where so many ranks of cells crowded the night, each visible dimly through the next, that I felt like I stood on the set of some low-budget television production, and the bars beyond the nearest cells were nothing more than dim lines painted on a black curtain, and I could walk through them if I wanted. Officer Friendly unlocked the door of one cell, and I obediently walked through. "Pick a bunk," he said, sounding almost human. He closed the door gently and shambled away. I stood there in the open darkness, bars in every direction. The cell contained 5 double-decker bunks, as did the next, and the next, and the next. 9 of the berths were occupied. One shadowy form turned over, opened an eye, then went back to sleep. I sat down on the one available bunk, a lower berth. A thin, striped mattress overlay metal slats. There was no pillow. The air smelled faintly of sweat and antiseptic. I took off my jacket and folded it neatly. I placed it where the pillow should have gone and lay down. I lay stiffly on my back, buttocks firmly clenched. Around me, 100 pairs of lungs quietly respired. Clamping my throat against sobs, I stared into the darkness and did not sleep.
Next time on The Accidental Terrorist.
In our next installment, Elder Shun wakes up to find himself still in jail. How will he fare in the general population? What horrors await in the breakfast line? Will he be released on bail until his trial date, or has he seen the last of open sky for months or even years? And what about Bob? Tune in for all the kidney-shiving answers.
Just 1 week from now!
The Accidental Terrorist. Spoken material, copyright 2007-2009, by William Shun. All rights reserved. For more readings by William Shun, please visit shun.net/podcast or search for William Shun, S-H-U-N-N, in the podcast directory of the iTunes Music Store. This recording has been a production of Sinister Regard.